in the altcoin season, if you are not searching for crypto gems on KuCoin, you're doing it wrong. As the home of altcoins, KuCoin is offering over 600 tradable coins. Whether you are a beginner or professional trader, you can always find a good product fit on KuCoin, ranging from earning products with passive income to derivatives trading with up to 100 times leverage. Sign up today to find the next crypto gem in DeFi, GameFi, NFT, and Metaverse. Join us with 10 million global investors and claim your $500 welcome bonus now. Welcome to KuCoin. It's KuCoin. Sign up to get a 500 USDT welcome bonus.
Welcome to the CoinGecko podcast. I'm your host, Bobby Young. Each week, we'll be interviewing someone from the blockchain industry to learn more about this fast-moving cryptocurrency economy. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. The CoinGecko podcast is produced each week to help you stay ahead of the curve. Show notes can be found at podcast.coingecko.com. I highly encourage you to join our newsletter where we send out top news in the crypto industry every Monday to Friday. Come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter and Telegram at CoinGecko.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ben, and as usual, I am the host of today's podcast. Today, it's kind of a new thing. We have more than one guest. We actually have three guests from Nansen here to talk about the FTX crash and, you know, what happened during and after the event. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
To provide some context for our listeners here, FTX, obviously everyone's aware of what happened to FTX, but Nansen produced a report on the FTX saga, you know, an on-chain report kind of detailing what happened. Some of the listeners might have, you know, where were you when it happened, I guess, for the whole research team?
Yeah, I think we're all based in, you know, different parts of the world. So I don't think we were together, at least not the three of us. But I was at Lisbon at that time, was staying with some colleagues from Nansen, actually. So we also have like a Lisbon hub where, you know, some people can work, you know, in the hub for, you know, 1 month every year. And so I was in the hub with a couple of my colleagues. And then, you know, I think it was just a roller coaster of emotions, right? Like, I think it all started with like disbelief. You know, I think in my head, I was like, you know, FTX is too big to fall. There were a lot of rumors on Twitter, obviously the whole, you know, saga when Sam and CZ was, you know, going back and forth on Twitter. It just kind of seemed like a casual dispute at that time. So I didn't really process like what was happening. And then all of a sudden, like a couple of days later, it just blew up and everything escalated, right? So I think we were all really just in disbelief, like really until, you know, users were unable to process their funds. And I think that was when it got hit really hard because you actually start seeing stories where, you know, people lost a lot of money on FTX and, you know, not just them, but like relatives or people that they sort of told about crypto was affected, right?
Yeah. So side note, at CG, it was during an offsite company trip. So it was pretty hectic as well. And funnily enough, it was also on my birthday, but I couldn't withdraw the funds. So yeah, I mean, just an interesting note for anyone who's listening. Yeah, we all got hit. And, you know, this brings me to my next question, my personal question on this, right? Did any of you get hit? You know, because I think a lot of people got hit, obviously, but some people, you know, experts who, or, you know, crypto influencers, everyone got hit. So I'm curious as to whether the team at Nansen as well.
Personally, I got hit a bit. Like I withdrew all my stuff, but I just forgot about another account I had. And then afterwards it came to me, like when it all was done, like, wait a minute, I still had something on like this account. So yeah, I didn't get hit big, but a little bit because of, I guess, bad bookkeeping from my side.
I think, you know, the other pressing question is, at what point did Nansen think, okay, well, we really need to do a report on this. Was it during the whole debacle, or is it like a little after that, okay, we really need to do something and write something?
Yeah, I think it was quite apparent from the very start, like when CoinDesk published the report, revealing that, you know, 40% of, you know, the 14.6 billion of Alameda's assets on their balance sheet was actually held in FTT tokens. So we thought, like, you know, at the time when the report was published, I think it was 2nd of November, I don't think it was clear to anyone how interconnected Alameda and FTX were. And I think it really came to as a surprise to most people in crypto that, you know, these two entities were actually so interconnected and so relevant to each other, right? I think more so in Nansen, like, we were appalled by, you know, the general lack of transparency that we've seen, you know, with the whole FTX collapse. We felt like for Nansen, like, we are in the position, you know, to provide on-chain footprints of what actually happened. Because, like, I guess no one else in the space was really covering, you know, what was happening, like, historically from the very start. So what we see on Twitter and, you know, just generally in the news is often just speculations, right? And we wanted to sort of debunk some theories that we've seen on Twitter. And we wanted to, like, get into, I guess, the very start of what happened. And more so, like, what's the implications for different people in the space, sort of what entities were involved throughout this whole saga. And obviously, like, through the analysis, we went through multiple methodologies, and we mostly, like, leverage our wallet labels that, you know, were obviously tagged by the entire team throughout this period. And yeah, we wanted to just date back to the very beginning and sort of see, like, okay, how were these two entities connected, and, you know, what was the focal point of our findings?
So yeah, I mean, let's just get right into the meat of it. You know, the first question everyone has is, hey, Alameda and FTX, are they the same? You know, what's the relationship? And Nansen kind of deep dived into that. You know, if not mistaken, you guys checked the transactions dating back to 2019 as well when it first launched. So yeah, tell us about the relationship. You know, I think everyone kind of really knew, but how deep is that relationship actually is?
So yeah, we basically, as you already said, we looked at transactions between them and also relating the FTT token, which was launched shortly after the FTX launch. And what we can say for sure is that they were deeply interconnected, like, even before launch. So they had transactions before FTX was even launched. They were, like, the only, probably the only third party interacting with FTX at that time. When they launched FTT, they had, like, very commingled relationship. So when they launched FTT, they had a team vesting contract for the FTT tokens, and an Alameda address is actually hard-coded as single recipient of that vesting contract. So something is going on. Probably they didn't have clear separations of addresses or something like that, or something else is going on. But you can clearly see that Alameda was involved, like, probably in the inception of FTX as well as the FTT token itself, and not just as investor.
So my next question is, why focus on FTT? Because you know, there's a lot of other transactions that go on between FTX exchange and probably Alameda as well, but, you know, why single out FTT?
Yeah, I think we wanted to focus on FTT to sort of display the relationship between Alameda and FTX, right? Because it's sort of the central point of connection between the two entities. And it was something that we could prove if we found leading, like, on-chain transactions, FTT was probably something very important to look into. So based on our research, it was obviously very evident that Alameda was sort of collateralizing FTT as they were able to take out loans directly from FTX, right? Which is speculated to be, you know, customer deposits, but this is not something that we can exactly confirm on-chain. So we'll just refrain from commenting on that. But it sort of showed that Alameda was, you know, able to access such funds through the collateralization of FTT tokens. So besides, like, the collusion of Alameda and FTX, you know, the research sort of dated back to May 2019, as Nick mentioned, when FTX just launched. Our report also presented the fact that the relationship between Alameda and FTX was extremely opaque. So there was no clear division between, you know, what the entities were doing. There was no clear transparency anywhere. Like, you can't really find this information anywhere. So we wanted to use FTX and Alameda's on-chain footprints as sort of the, you know, leading indicators as to what we could find in the report.
So there has been a lot of speculation about how Alameda was actually behind the collapse of Luna and subsequently KC that kind of kick-started all this. At the time, there was probably a lot of things happening behind the scenes. I'm not sure whether you guys can comment on the inner workings that happened during that time. I think it was in May of this year, where there are probably a lot of fishy things happen behind the scenes. Is that true?
So as for the impact on-chain, we can't really see what happened actually, since most of it was like happening within FTX or like some venture deals of them being up or some loans which happened partly off-chain. But what we can see is that around exactly that time, when 3SE actually collapsed, there were huge inflows of FTT to FTX, where people say this must have been the collateralization of the loan, which means this would have been sort of their last resort. So they weren't probably in a good place at that time. But as to the concrete workings, we would rather not comment as we cannot see them on chain. But the timing is very, very peculiar.
So, you know, all right, we kind of talked about what happened, kind of gave some context. But all right, let's just get to the grunt of it, which is, yeah, no, November 9th, November 8th, or November 2nd, really, right after the CoinDesk report came out. What really happened during then? You know, what happened during the bank run? Yeah, could you guys elaborate more on that?
Yeah, so what we sort of observe using on-chain data was we can sort of definitely see the market resorting into somewhat of a panic mode in the 7 days leading up to the event. So between the 2nd all the way to the 7th of November, sort of around $400 odd million dollars was leaving. I think about 450 million was leaving FTX, and about 410 of those, or 411 of those, actually going into Binance. So you can see definitely the market reacted very quickly to that. What was really interesting for us is when we sort of do almost like a forensics of the on-chain data, was it was obvious that 24 hours prior to FTX halting the exchange, there were wallets that were able to withdraw significant amount of funds out of the exchange. And I believe at the top of the leaderboard, we identified a wallet that was able to withdraw about $245 million out of the exchange. It's sort of very, very interesting to see that flow. And I believe it's on the 8th of November, when we look at on-chain data, we also found a significant transaction where FTX actually sent approximately $92 million of BID token to Alameda. So you can definitely see a lot of movements, moving of fund, but also people who are able to, get significant amount out of the exchange. On a side note, we also thought there was a lot of rumors going on Twitter, and one of the sort of attention that was one of the sort of tweets that was garnering a lot of attention was around Alameda's Caroline's tweet on the offer to buy the tokens at $22. So we got a little cheeky and we thought, why not, make sense of what was Alameda's position at that time? Did they really have that kind of dry powder to make that purchase? But, we reviewed all of the list of wallets that we can identify on the Ethereum chain. And, at that time, it seems like they actually did not have that kind of dry powder on the site to make that sort of call. But yeah, when we sort of walk through the events, it was really interesting to use from an on-chain data perspective to verify some of the events or some of the narrative that was going on viral on social media.
So you kind of highlighted some transactions that were, huge red flags, which is obviously that huge withdrawal funds. Is there any speculation or maybe any wallet addresses that you have identified that could access these funds, or were they all known?
We were able to, I think in our report, in the top few wallets, we did identify a few that was Binance and Coinbase that made it to the top. But I think the most of them were pretty much anonymous, but we have the Nansen labels, and they were sort of significant to have, they sort of have history to be known as, a token millionaire or ETH millionaire in terms of their balance prior to the event. So they're not fresh wallets per se here. Yeah.
One question I can think of is, because this whole saga is been sensationalized everywhere across headlines, etc., etc. Obviously, there's a lot of rumors, speculation. You have to kind of sift through the noise. And one of the main things that media would likes to do is push a narrative that doesn't really make sense. And I guess, you know, is there anything that the media has consistently stated or pushed for, but it's not really true based on your own data?
We didn't identify anything that was untrue because we were very strict in terms of our methodology. We were not there to sort of, we didn't go in with a perspective of, you know, debunking or verifying, but rather, okay, what can we make sense of the on-chain data? That was the sort of the framework we went in with. But what was interesting, perhaps, that was not mentioned enough, I think often in the mainstream or the speculated narrative, is how early actually the domino has started falling. And, you know, like what Nick mentioned and also what Sandra mentioned is it's actually many issues that was compounding that lead to, you know, the ultimate fall of this domino. And one of the things was really around the Terra Luna and the 3AC situation. You actually go back all the way to then. I think often we, when we're talking about, you know, the FTX saga, we look at it as a snapshot of, okay, what happened, or that week leading up to the bank run event. But actually, you know, a lot of sort of mishandling an issue was actually could be traced way back when we look at on-chain data.
So, you know, this speaks to importance of on-chain data, right? And which is kind of like the main message of today's session as well, you know. Nansen analysts, all of you were, it would be safe to say that you all are on-chain sleuths, on-chain data analysts, but I think one of the biggest problems with blockchain is there's just so much data. And so my question is, you know, will being an on-chain sleuth help prevent or help avoid this scenario for would-be participants in the space?
Yeah, I think one of the things with on-chain data is to hopefully level the playing field a little bit. So on-chain data alone is not enough. What Nansen strives to do is also make that digestible and also easily accessible for people to interpret and to make sense of what's going on in the market. So a popular sort of initiative that came out of this event was really around the proof of reserve, and Nansen was very much spearheading that. And we wouldn't say whether or not it can be avoided, but at least there is more transparency and hopefully from there more accountability, you know, in the industry. So with Nansen's proof of reserve, the whole initiative was to allow market participants to better track exchanges, token holdings and transaction, or entities, tokens, holding and transaction. Of course, there's still limitations to that because it's really dependent on the wallets that we can identify and verify and label them and make sure that the labels are accurate and sound. But it also doesn't really show, you know, what the net worth is, because off-chain, you know, there could be other assets or liabilities that that are not reflected in the on-chain data. So it is, you know, still a work in progress in terms of initiative, but at least it's, you know, step hopefully in the right direction after this aftermath. Yeah.
So, just a segue. You know, there's obviously a lot of people happy about the reserves because people are becoming more comfortable. But there's also the question of whether, you know, it's just displaying your assets, or it's not really displaying your liabilities, and it's kind of like creating an Excel sheet and just putting my numbers in. Hey, you know, this is my proof of reserves. But do you think there is room for improvement? If so, what would it look like?
Yeah, I think there always will be. And I guess that's what motivates us three as research analysts. I mean, part of what's exciting of our job is we are constantly thinking about matrix, about better way to sort of signal what's going on in the market. And that's very much got to do with risk. If anything, this market cycle really taught us is the many different kind of risks that we often overlook. So if anything, you know, what the proof of reserve should show you is not assurance, but get you to question things like your counterparty risks, you know, how liquid your assets might be. So it's about prompting you to think further and to do further due diligence rather than accepting any entity saying that, okay, this is a check, this is a tick box. It's not meant to be that way, but rather to stimulate you to think further and to dig, you know, deeper into the on-chain data space.
Yeah. So what would you say, you know, is the next step? Is there anything else that you know, as users or people participating in space to kind of educate themselves? Because, you know, what I found really interesting with Mantis, you know, one of the methodologies that you identify that is kind of so narrowed down the space through Twitter, which is what generally any crypto analyst does. But it's kind of interesting that, you know, we also rely a bit on social media to kind of figure out what's going on.
So I think it is really important to use social media to sort of get a starting point sometimes, since on-chain so much is happening and sometimes you don't really know where to look at. And I think for me personally, social media is a very good starting point. You hear some rumors and then you actually see, can I verify it on-chain? Like what is happening there? And I think it's a good starting point to dig deeper. But where many people, I think, then also lose money is if they stop that, like they read something in social media, they think it must be true and they don't use this as a starting point to actually dig deeper. And then they sort of trust the public images of these people or entities. For example, I think a lot of why many people didn't withdraw early enough, although signs were there, was because the public image of FTX, of Alameda, of SBF were so good and people believed them to be like so successful without actually checking it. That they just acted too late. And I think you should always take social media as a grain of salt, but as actually sort of identifying the smoke and then looking for the actual fire on chain.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with everything Nick said. I think social media is really good just for you to stay on top of the market, right? But I think in a way, like you can't be too heavily reliant on what's presented on social media, because a lot of the times people are, you know, just using it as their own agenda, right? I think, yeah, like most people will use social media as a tool just to prove that, you know, they're trying to make a statement about something, but they need a medium to make that statement on, right? And I think just going back to my point of like, you know, what you see on social media and like Twitter oftentimes is like, there's a lot of noise and there's a lot of fluff that you have to individually like sift through. And, you know, we've seen that in the past couple of days about the whole wrapped ETH fight that was going around. And, you know, Crypto Twitter made a joke and then that they might actually be in trouble and people actually started believing that, right? And it even got covered on like Bloomberg, I think yesterday or something. So it's quite, it's quite insane that, you know, it could go from like a joke to actually something that people trust so heavily. So I think at the end of the day, like on-chain data is really there as a more transparent mean for you to be like, you know, looking at evidence that you hear on Twitter. You always need another platform to sort of verify and prove that, you know, this is something that you can spot on-chain. So yeah, just my two cents.
Yeah, I think one thing I probably can speak of from the report perspective, because the way we did it with the report is we sort of use a grounded theory approach. Because to say that we look at it objectively, it's a bit hard, because like you mentioned, you know, we are all exposed to social media as research analysts. So it's not as though when we did this research, it's like a lab environment. So what we did was we went in with, okay, what are the key themes? And then we started with the themes when we did this investigation. And then from the themes, we asked ourselves, okay, what are the on-chain data that fit into those timeline? And then we try to sort of piece and weave everything together to get a sort of a broad picture, an overview of what actually happened. So the, like what Sandra mentioned, the social media was really just a tool. But what we try to do different compared to the other sort of research platform or journalists is we really canvas ourselves and set really, really strong boundaries and make sure that whatever interpretation we make have to come from the on-chain data.
You know, we thought about asking our guests some interesting questions about themselves, you know, crypto related, but not really related to the topic at hand. And I think one of the things that we can ask is, you know, rate yourself from 1 to 10 in terms of how good of a crypto trader you are. And I guess we'll start with Louisa.
I'll probably be a 1 to 2. I'll be really honest. I don't trade. I see trading as a full-time job and I'm too lazy. But I guess part of the job is to understand, you know, what are some of the popular indicators of markets. So from a textbook sense, yes, I get them. But no, when it comes to putting them into action, I'm a 1 or 2.
What about Sandra?
Yeah, I think I would like to think that I'm okay. But I think my portfolio would say otherwise. So I think I do a really bad job at just like bag holding a lot of my assets. So, you know, I try to have proper risk management. And I think we always try. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, I can't really execute what I'm thinking of in terms of my trading strategies. So I end up just bag holding it and it, you know, most likely will go to zero.
I think I'm more on Sandra's side there. I give great advice, but don't follow it through myself, which then probably makes me around a 3 or 4.
So it's so funny, right? Because I mean, I myself agree. I think with Nick, I would say I'm like a 3 or 4. I give advice, but I don't listen to my own advice. And it's kind of strange because we're all crypto analysts, but here we are, you know, horrible traders. The other question I have is there are a lot of people who want to get into space, but how would you give advice to newcomers? And where do I start? Where do I learn? There's so much things going on. How do I get into crypto?
I guess being Nansen analysts, we have to say you have to try Nansen. We actually do have a free trial. So it's a good way for people to start. Then after that, we also have freemium. So a lot of our good sort of macro market dashboard are available on freemium. We sort of talk about social media earlier, but you know, there's always caveats and limitations. So always verify what you read. Don't take anything as is. Personally, I'm a bit of a geek, so I'll recommend MIT. They actually have a lot of free courses on blockchain. So for people who really want to understand the fundamentals, make use of all the freebies out there. And yeah, there's a lot of open lectures.
I think just don't feel scared to like actually reach out to people. Because like that's the one like main thing that I've learned through, you know, being in the space, that actually people are really willing to help if you decide to ask them. The only thing is like, okay, you just need to make the effort to make the first step to actually ask the question. And to be honest, like most people will actually, you know, lend their hands to actually help you, right? That was like how I started in the space. It was just a lot of like asking questions and, you know, being the dumb person in the room is sometimes, I mean, it's oftentimes like the best way to learn. And I think, you know, as someone who's just starting out, just keep trying different protocols, keep, you know, asking questions, even if it's dumb sounding, like just ask it, right? And that's the main piece of advice that we give.
For me personally, it really depends what you want to do. Like if you want to just hold and use it as an investment, then you probably can just use some exchange and hold it there. But if you really want to get into the space, I think there's no way around actually taking some money, not too much, but like enough that you slightly care about it and just putting it somewhere. Just try out a bunch of stuff. If you have a bit of skin in the game, like this will likely just motivate you to like really learn about the protocol. And then if you make your first like gains or losses and like you get a little bit like nervous when something happens, this just, I think it's the right motivator to kickstart your journey into the rabbit hole, at least for myself. It was like that. I think my first coin I bought was Ampleforth, like the mother of Algus Davis. And it went like up and down. And I was like really stressed out and reading so much about it. And this is basically where it started for me.
You know, I guess that really covers a lot of what we set out to talk about today. Thank you so much for your time. And before I like to end the session, I just kind of ask, do you guys have anything you'd like to share to our listeners? You know, maybe anything about Nansen at all?
Yeah, I think if anyone is interested to read more on the report or just read more on like what Nansen Alpha does and more generally like the Nansen research team, you can always visit our research portal. You can also go straight to the nansen.ai website just to see what we're up to. We're always active on Twitter. You know, a lot of pretty funny content, but it's also backed by on-chain data, of course. You know, you can just visit our Twitter. We're always online if you want to chat about anything, honestly.
All right. Thank you so much for your time, Nick, Louisa, and Sandra. Yeah, glad to have you on.
All right. That wraps up the show. Thank you for listening to the CoinGecko podcast with Bobby. If you like our show and want to know more, check out podcast.coingecko.com or please leave us a review on iTunes. If you have any feedback, do drop us an email at hello@coingecko.com. Join us for more next week. See ya!
This podcast is provided as part of the overall information on cryptocurrency contained on our website, is for your general information only, and does not howsoever constitute any endorsement, financial or investment advice, nor any solicitation or offer of securities or other financial instruments. CoinGecko and the podcast presenter makes no warranties, implied or express, of any kind in relation to this podcast, including, without limitation, the accuracy and updatedness of its content. All opinions and recommendations therein the podcast are based on the personal opinion of the presenter. Please conduct your own research and procure professional advice should you, at your own risk, decide to howsoever invest or trade in relation to the content contained in the podcast.